Ours are good.
Yeah.
20 years.
Ready when you are.
Okay, I'm going to call to order this March 1st meeting of the House Committee on Education's Subcommittee on Higher Education. Welcome to all of you to this to today's session, which should be a very interesting one. We're going to be talking about those areas where our K-12 system overlap with our higher ed system, and some really exciting things that are happening that point the way to further kinds of collaborations that will make it easier for our students to transition from one stage in their life to another. And towards that end, we have a number of people who are going to be talking about dual credit, expanded options, accelerated learning here in Oregon. We initially had planned to also hear from Ames McGinnis from NCHEMS, the National Center for Higher Education Management Systems, who is also going to be testifying on the Senate side today, but he is stuck in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And so either New Orleans or Baton Rouge, somewhere down there in Louisiana. We'll hope to hear from him at another time. So let's begin our overview of dual credit, and we have Larry Shane from the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and Suzanne Daggett from the Department of Ed. And why don't we hear from you two, and then we'll be hearing from Karen Neitzel from Hood River. Maybe not. Okay, so before you begin, I'm going to open this informational hearing. And Larry and Suzanne, please introduce yourselves as you speak. And as you address the chairs, today I'm the presiding co-chair, so you can just direct your questions or comments to me.
Oh, okay.
Great.
All right, thank you.
Good.
Well, I'm Larry Shane with the Oregon Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development, and I'm here on behalf of Camille Price, our commissioner, and just going to visit a little bit about dual credit. Would you like me to talk about dual credit and then have Suzanne go? Or
yes.
Yes. Yes, please.
So just a little bit of background and some definition when it comes to dual credit. It's a term that's often used for a number of different accelerated learning opportunities in Oregon, and what I'm going to specifically address are the types of opportunities that exist when a high school teacher is offering a college course on the high school campus. And that's a little bit different than, say, advanced placement or expanded options or some of those others. And I'm also going to be pretty specific about community colleges, although I do know somewhat about the Oregon University System offerings in that arena as well. So again, dual credit is defined as awarding secondary and post-secondary credit for a course offered in a high school during regular school hours, and it is offered or taught by a school district employee. And that that high school teacher has been allowed to or certified to offer that course by a credit-granting institution. All of Oregon's 17 community colleges currently have that program in place, and four of the seven Oregon University System institutions also offer that program. As I mentioned earlier, it is one of the various early college experience programs in Oregon, and it has been in existence for, you know, a couple of decades in different forms. I remember when I was in high school, and I won't mention when, but I grew up in Klamath County, and I had an accelerated learning option, dual credit, riding 121 through Oregon Institute of Technology. Cool. So you can kind of guesstimate the math how long that's been. Currently, our dual credit programs are serving about 25,000 students just in the community college part of it. There's another 3,000 to 4,000 Oregon University System students. So, you know, we're close to 30,000 students. That's an unduplicated headcount that are studying both lower division collegiate and what we call career and technical education courses in Oregon. And those students last year earned close to 200,000 credits. So it's a pretty sizable program in Oregon. And the source for that information is both the Oregon Community College Unified Reporting System and then also Oregon University Systems research staff. In terms of where we are right now with dual credit, and this is directly in relation to the bill that I'm talking about, the SB 254A, there are dual credit standards that are now in place. About a year ago, the Joint Boards of Education adopted program approval standards for dual credit programs in Oregon, and that is for all, both community college and the university system programs. The standards assure program alignment across those programs, and they are based on a national criteria that is from the National Alliance of Concurrent Enrollment Partnerships that focus on faculty preparedness, student performance, valid assessment, and curricular alignment. All of the programs in Oregon currently will need to be assessed and approved by June of 2013 in order to continue offering dual credit in Oregon. Right now we have two programs, the program at Lane Community College and the program at Central Oregon Community College, that have they've gone through the application process. They've been reviewed by the Unified Education Enterprise, which sits underneath the Joint Boards of Education that I mentioned earlier. And the Unified Education Enterprise's Dual Credit Oversight Committee has reviewed those applications, asked clarifying questions, and received those responses, and has recommended to the Unified Education Enterprise that those programs be approved. The enterprise has then entertained those on February 15th, so just a couple weeks ago, and now they're making recommendation to the Joint Boards of Ed that they be approved programs. So those are the first two. We've done kind of, and by we I mean the Oregon Department of Education and Community College and Workforce Development, have done kind of an informal survey to see how many are planning on applying this year to go through the standards process, and roughly 9 or 10 more institutions will be going through it in 2011. So, where do we go right now in terms of dual credit? Again, the program approval process, as I mentioned, we're right in the midst of that, and a lot of institutions will be going through that over this next year and a half or so. We also have been taking a look at teacher qualification, and by we, I mean our department and on the community college side of things, the Council of Instructional Administrators. Those are the chief academic officers at all 17 of Oregon's community colleges. And looking at ways in which high school teachers could gain that certification or that approval to offer those dual credit programs or dual credit courses in Oregon's high schools. That council has made a recommendation to, and it's been approved by the Oregon President's Council for the community colleges, to have in place standards and a very thoughtful procedure for such things as conditional approval or an approval for teaching that would be based on completing a few more training requirements with professional development requirements for instructors. So we should see a few more teachers added to that pool as we move forward.
Larry, yeah. Could I just interrupt you?
Yeah.
Just if you could expand on that a little more, what the differences might be in qualifications for someone who goes a traditional route of training to be a high school teacher as opposed to teach an accredited college or university.
Certainly. Chair Dembro, the qualifications for, and it's a little bit mixed at the community college level, the qualifications for teaching a lower division collegiate course are essentially a master's degree in that subject area. It's also possible to have a master's degree, say, in education or some other field, related field, and a certain number of graduate-level credits achieved on your resume and your vitae. That is usually in the neighborhood of 24 credits. For the career and technical education courses, it's a little bit different. Sometimes it requires a master's degree, sometimes it does not. But there are teachers in both arenas that are fairly close. Now, you're probably aware that there are a lot of teachers that have a Master of Arts in Teaching. And our teacher preparation programs focus very much on the Master of Art in Teaching or possibly Master's in Education, and not so much on subject area master's degrees. Mm-hmm. So we have seen, and this is not a scientific, you know, statement I'm making, but we have seen somewhat of a reduction in teachers that have that level of graduate training, particularly in lower division collegiate courses. But some are close, and so that's where we can do some conditional approval for teachers, and then they pick up a course or two here or there, and they become fully approved to offer it. Is that what you're...
Yes. Okay. And is this a problem that's... This is a problem. I know this, so I won't put it in the form of a question. This is more of a problem in the rural area parts of the state than it is in the urban areas, right?
Yeah.
So for some of the schools in the more remote areas, they're having a hard time actually having teachers who are qualified to teach. And so the choice becomes perhaps doing it through an online modality or finding a way to get a conditional permission for the instructor.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and looking at even some hybrid models of instruction and looking at who may be the instructor of record and some of those types of things.
Great. Anybody have any other questions at this point before Larry carries on? Okay, go on.
Well, the final thing I was going to talk about is one of the things that our department is looking at in the Dual Credit Oversight Committee, which I mentioned sits underneath the Unified Education Enterprise. What we're looking at are ways in which to, and this gets to your point, Chair Dembro, increasing access, affordability, and ensuring that students are successful in these programs. The program standards being in place and the program approval process really helped us codify the quality that these programs exhibit, and now we're looking at now how can we grow that even more. We've seen incremental growth over the years, but we know that there's a lot of room yet to grow.
Larry, could you say something, say more about the technical side of things, dual credit applies to both lower division collegiate mm-hmm. and vocational technical or technical professional.
Mm-hmm.
Are there differences in the way those roll out, in the field?
Chair Dembro, in terms of program approval and in terms of how the programs are set up, there are no differences now, with the exception of what I mentioned around teacher qualification. There may not be a requirement for a master's degree in that subject area in order to offer, say, a dual credit program in graphic design, culinary arts, something of that nature. But in terms of the curriculum, in terms of what the students need to exhibit in terms of accomplishment and so forth, it's identical. I think the numbers break down somewhere around 16,000 of the 25 or so thousand I mentioned high school students that did dual credit last year. That's in lower division collegiate. The other number is career and technical education. So it's a little bit smaller.
Yes,
Chair. Thanks, Chair. Thanks for your comments. Is there any collaboration between our higher ed system, community colleges, and the OUS system, and maybe you're going to talk about this when you get to ODE, but in terms of what type of courses the colleges are encouraging the high schools to be able to offer dual credits in? I mean, in terms of that smorgasbord, if you will, about, you talked about writing 121, and there could be other stuff, obviously, but is there any collaboration in the process there that says from the higher ed system saying, we'd like you to be able to offer more of these because this will help students to access our system better, or Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Representative Johnson and Chair Dembrough, and just to ask a clarifying question, are you speaking in terms of like the Oregon University system schools
and community colleges and both, community colleges. I guess,
okay.
Sure, in terms of the ultimate success of the folks in their higher ed career.
Sure. Representative Johnson and Chair Dembrough, there's been quite a bit of collaboration around the program standards. You know, mentioning that the joint boards of education put those in place, all the way down to the dual credit oversight committee is made up of faculty administrators from K-12, the community colleges, and the university system. In terms of encouraging certain types of programs, most of the studies around student success have been in lower division collegiate, things like the Writing 121 series, mathematics, mm-hmm. Secondary language, history, you know, those areas. And that is the bulk of where the students are currently doing the coursework or in those areas. In terms of career and technical education, there's a lot of collaboration between community colleges and K-12 around Perkins, Carl Perkins Act, career and technical education programs of study. And that is focused primarily on alignment between secondary and post-secondary, but also the articulation that may be embedded in there, which involves both the lower division collegiate coursework and also career and technical education programs.
Okay. Yeah. Great. Thank you.
Yes, Rep. Parker.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. We're wrestling in this building a bit with the question of how online education gets handled in K-12. Mm-hmm. We're talking now about K-12 teachers who are teaching college materials. I recall my son taking an online course when he was in high school, but it was offered through a university. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure what the intersection is here, I think K-12 governance would apply to these classes, even though they're college material, they're being taught by K-12 instructors in some cases. Am I right about that interpretation, and would you care to expand on that a little bit if there are thoughts you have or lessons we might know of?
If you'd like to. I could toss something in there from my...
Suzanne,
I'm sorry, Representative... Harker and
First, could you introduce yourself for the record? Thanks.
I thought my introduction tied up to my remarks. And this is sometimes my problem, which is that I'm so eager to speak. So
I do the same thing.
So my apologies. Suzanne Daggett, this is my 31st year in education in Oregon, my sixth year at the Oregon Department of Education and EII and on the Secondary Post-Secondary Connections team. And I'll stop there for now. What I would like to say in regards to that is, in some cases, it's up to the high school and the high school principal to determine if the course the student is taking meets the standards or the requirements that high school has towards the diploma. Even though, and because the teacher is owned, if you will, and the curriculum is owned by the post-secondary institution, they put those pieces together when the high school determines if they're going to accept that. And this is saying from my role as a building principal and as a district office person that we would look at what the course is and how does it align with the requirements in the high school, and if you can take that credit and meet those particular requirements. The requirements of the standards of the course and the teacher's requirements are tied to the post-secondary institution that houses it, if you will.
Just following up on that, I think that this is, many of us have a sense that this is an area for further development, right? And I mean, a lot of conversations about how these partnerships, that the online modality offers us a lot of possibilities, mm-hmm. and how can we do it in a really deliberative, strategic kind of manner. You know, obviously it's got to be part of the conversation about rural access, mm-hmm. I think, but not only rural access. Mm-hmm. So I would like to, and I don't know, Suzanne, if you had a direction you wanted to go, but at some point I'd also like us to talk about the way that these courses are funded, mm-hmm. right? I mean, presumably the teachers are being paid by the district. It's part mm-hmm. of their regular assignment. But the community colleges are also getting FTE for it. You know, I'm wondering if we could explore that a little bit at some point. I don't know if this is the right point in time to do that.
Representative Dembro, perhaps if I go through my list and give you other pieces of the jigsaw puzzle, then there would be some obvious points perhaps to go into that. And so I'm going to defer to Larry if he has anything else to say.
No, I think that's a good idea. Yeah.
Okay. Well, again, Representative Dembro, committee, my name is Suzanne Daggett. Again, I am with the Oregon Department of Education, my 31st year in education in Oregon, but I started out in Minnesota and then came here via California. And I have been a teacher for over 20 years in language arts, and I was a building principal and a district office administrator in the Hillsborough School District prior to coming to the Oregon Department of Education. And I'm going to try to make my remarks brief. There's quite a few other topics in terms of accelerated learning options. And I submitted this document. We had some things submitted yesterday, and we found some errors in it, and we've updated it. So the staff over there has this copy. In any case, I tend to talk real fast, so... And I'm sure that you won't have any trouble interrupting me, but I tend to go on. As you know, I'm sure you're aware of the benefits of the accelerated learning options, the connectivity for students, raising the level of curriculum, not just the opportunity to get credit, but raising the level of curriculum and standards and education for the students across the board, and the successful transition into their post-secondary steps. The piece that I have had the most experience with is expanded options. When I first came to the Oregon Department of Education, I was part of the three-person team that developed the OARs off of the statute in 2005. So I've been with it for the long haul. I was also a part of the facilitation group that made the amendments to it in 2007. And as you know, expanded options differs from a lot of the other aspects in accelerated credits is that the funding for that, for example, comes specifically for the state school fund. The money changes hands institution to institution. The students who are involved in that, they show up and they do their work. The money is not part of their curriculum, so to speak. Students are 16 years of age or older. They have to be a junior or senior in high school. They can only have a maximum of 2 years on this program. They have to have an education plan and profile, so the courses they select have to be part of that education plan. It can't be, oh, I'd like to do basket weaving, that would be so cool. But it has to be part of their program and to get their electives and their required courses. It can be either. It can be career and technical education, can be academic coursework, and so on. So it has some funnel and it has some requirements to it. Let's see. This ALS program also has waivers so that if school districts do offer other accelerated credit options, they do not have to participate. They can apply to the state for a waiver. They can also do it on the basis of financial hardship, which has been kind of problematic for folks because everyone is in financial difficulties. And it is much easier to show that they offer additional programs that meet the needs of students rather than on financial need for other programs. We have currently 39 school districts that have waivers, and some are based on both, but primarily on the other options that they offer. Courses that they take in expanded options have to be focused on their high school diploma. They can be working towards a certificate or associate degree or baccalaureate. Not that you can get completely there on the 2 years of high school, but in that direction. They cannot be duplicative to what's already being offered in the high school. Let's see, last year we had 1,767 students participate, and that's up a little bit from the previous year at 1,666. In contrast to dual credit, it's not that big a slice of students, but it's significant in the fact that I remember when it first came on, school districts were quite in angst over offering it because of the funding mainstream. And what we've found, obviously, it hasn't been that great of participation, but it is becoming more mainstream. Okay, this meets the needs of this niche of student and moving forward.
Excuse me, Suzanne. Sure. Rep. Parker, did you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. How and where is the decision made regarding duplicative classes?
Representative Parker, Co-Chair Dembro. It happens at the district level. And that's in the rules and the statutes that that's what happens first. And the students can apply to have that reconsidered at their local board level. So if the high school says, no, this isn't the case, the parents can take that forward to the local board. If the local board says or rules against them, then it kicks up to the state superintendent's office. We have never had a request for that. I have taken a lot of parent phone calls, nonetheless. And really what I advise people to look at is the curriculum embedded in the courses in question, and how do the standards and the outcomes line up? Because even if you are looking at writing 121, which is going to be an appropriate course for a student to take, it doesn't address the range of standards you would have, let's say, in a language arts 12 or language arts 11, because that does more than just writing. It deals with literature and a myriad of other standards in case. So I have fielded a few of those things and advise school districts who call just to be specific on how you determine if it's duplicative or not. And really, like I said, we have not had any come forward to us. That's not to say they haven't had any locally, mm-hmm. but I don't know.
So just following up on that, so for example, if looking at the case of writing 121, if a student wanted to use expanded options to take writing 121 at Portland State, for example, and the district was already offering it as a dual credit option in the school, then that was that request would probably be denied. Is that right?
It could be. And that has come up, and I've also had school districts say to me, well, we have an agreement with such and such a community college. And I said, but the law doesn't say you can be exclusive. You can do both, and you're required to have straightforward agreements with your post-secondary partners, but it can't be exclusionary. And that is because there are students who really need the services, let's say, of an Oregon State or the University of Oregon or Portland State for more than writing 121, let's say, and they have a specific area and their needs would not be met. And that's been a challenge for school districts, though, because the same course could be offered for much less at Lane than it could be at the University of Oregon, and easily gotten to more than the other. And that the cost to go to the University of Oregon would mess up their budget, so to speak, highly impact that, and perhaps make it more difficult for the school district to offer the courses to more students within their budget. So it is a fine balance.
Mm-hmm. How often are requests denied for financial reasons, financial impact reasons, Suzanne? Has that been very common?
Representative Dembro, you mean in terms of the waiver?
In terms of the waiver, I'm sorry.
The only time we've denied that is if there hasn't been any documentation. And so my response to the school district, because I follow up on those, is to say there really is no reason why we can't approve this, but in terms of my responsibility to the people of Oregon and the funding, I would like to have some documentation on which to base that decision. And usually then they would send, and the waiver process does ask for documentation, such as the local board, the budget, and so on, asking for documentation, and then we put that in the file. The difficulty with the waiver process is there really is no criteria. Mm-hmm. Financial hardship. You would hope that they can give you something significant to that.
Mm-hmm. So to your way of thinking, that has not really been a problem because it's not, the attempt to get a waiver has not really been pursued.
Representative, in terms
reasons.
Of funding purposes, we have four. four waivers in
effect,
over the course of the time, for based specifically on financial reasons. And the reason is it's much easier for them to show we already offer dual credit. We have advanced placement. We have IB. We have a lot of other things. The difficulty I see is those, again, those programs, and this is the great thing about Oregon, but it is also, a kind of a sticky wicket for folks, is that in Oregon, you have a great array of opportunities for students, but they don't all meet everyone's needs. And just because you offer advanced placement, the students that could benefit from expanded options or a career and technical education course aren't going to get those needs met. So most districts have an array, and it depends on their own local needs. They try to meet their local needs and so on.
Mm-hmm. And just one last question. In terms of, the numbers of, how many students take advantage and how many denials there have been, et cetera, the department does a regular report, doesn't it, to mm-hmm. the State Board
yes.
of Education? And maybe that could be sent to us, and so we could share it with the committee.
Certainly. Great. I do have a copy if you have a specific question that you wanted to ask.
No, I think it would be useful. I saw the last report, and I think it was very positive in terms of the expansion of the program, mm-hmm. and et cetera.
Okay. So I'll continue. Okay. The other pieces that come off of that report, really to give you a sense of the participation of different groups, 16% this year in terms of minority groups, and that's a little bit up from last year, but the categories changed because we moved into more federal categories, and so it's a little bit of a shift, but that's been kind of consistent, around 15-16% of minority populations participating. 26% economically disadvantaged, and I recall in the beginning of SB 300, as it developed, the at-risk student, economically disadvantaged student, was a key a niche that this bill was geared towards. And it has gone up this year from 22 to 26. TAG students has gone down from 15 to 12, but it's still in the same range. And rural students, it has gone down from 32% to 25%. And I had kind of anticipated it going up, but not. Again, as I said, the waivers last year when the report, and you'll see some differences in the report when you look at it to the numbers that are now. The report itself said there were 35 waivers, and that was based on the year in question during 9-10, and now there are 39 waivers. But most of them, the majority, are based on already offering additional programs. Another key target population for the bill was those students who had dropped out of school, and to pull them back in. And I saw many school districts really seeing this as an opportunity to pull in students that they had lost and direct them into higher education and perhaps as a means to reengage them in school and in the community. We've had 22 in the last year, and that's kind of steadily gone up. At first it was only a single digit, and now we've gone further in that. The data that you get on this system, it's a very interesting data collection. We get at the end of the year, because the report is required through statute that school districts have to submit. It's a one-page. It's fairly simple. How many students participated, their ethnicity, and so on, how many credits, high school and post-secondary, and so on, and what other local options, and I'll speak to those in a minute. The other piece of data that we get is from the community colleges and the universities, the public universities, and they are supposed to submit to us the registrations. So when you look at this report, just so that you understand it, that the numbers aren't going to match up, because we get the early registrations, all those students that say, yes, I'm going to participate, I'm going to register, on the front end from the post-secondary institutions, and on the end of it from the high schools and the districts, we get those that actually completed. So there is a bit of a difference there, just so you know when you're reading that. Well, these numbers don't match. We have 12 of the 17 community colleges. It's been consistent. Have participated, and 5 of the 7 Oregon universities have participated. There are some that have not, or have they at least haven't submitted the information. So after expanded options, do you have any questions per se on that one, and then I would go on?
I would have just one question about, you know, you mentioned the decline in the rural numbers. Do you have any sense of what's causing that? What caused that?
Representative Dembrough, I believe it is due to financial issues also, and the development of more local options that would perhaps serve those same students in a different way. I know that in some areas of Eastern Oregon, many of the school districts have looked at pooling their resources, if you will, to do programs of study. And then you have students who are looking at career and technical education, and then they can have a specific program that helps meet their needs that way. So that's an option mm-hmm. I see happening.
And are most of the waivers, are more of the waivers in the urban areas or the rural areas? Do you see any pattern?
You know, I have that list with me.
Are the waivers by district or
by district.
Or numbers of students?
By district.
So
by
if
district.
Portland were to get a waiver, for example, it would have a lot more impact than Spray.
Which right? It does. Portland does have it. Because they clearly offer a variety of different options. So it's mixed. And I can, and that list is on our website. If you go to the Expanded Options website webpage, you'll see which ones were offered in which year and to which school district, so you can get a sense of that.
Great, thank you.
Okay. The next is the CTE programs of study, and this is a very interesting development based off of the new Perkins Law. In 2006, federal legislation, and so what happened as a result of that, the state, the Oregon Department of Education and the Department of Community Colleges and Workforce Development worked together to merge much of what was tech prep into comprehensive programs, and the federal funding stream requires that collaboration. And the key pieces, the four core elements of programs of study that are embedded in high schools and community colleges are standards and content, so it has to be consistent, progressive, alignment and articulation so that the courses align and the hopes that they will become articulated. And the key piece there is having teachers at the high school level that are qualified by the rules to offer that articulation, articulated courses. Technical skill assessment. In the past, technical skill assessment was determined based on course grades. And we all know, of course, grades, a lot of different things go into grading necessarily than actual technical skill. And so we have migrated from grades as a data element to actual proficiency on a specific technical skill assessment for those areas. And that has been part of the challenge. And working students to not just what had been, I think, a singleton course in, let's say, auto shop, now needs to be a comprehensive program working from the auto technology from high school into the community college, and there are specific technical skills tied to that. It's no longer, I would say, we have a lot of great history in the high schools with current technical education, vocational education, and so on. What this new bill, the federal legislation, did was try to pull those together to make them not as isolated, but as a consistent and comprehensive program, so students are more connected to their next steps and business and industry skills. And then I'll get to that in a minute. The other piece is student support services, so a lot of it's wrapped up in advising and guidance and so on. We are still in the transition, and this bill, this legislation goes till 2013. So we're on a trajectory, and we had over 600 programs apply for state approval. And that is, of course, you know, you don't have that many school districts, but there are multiple programs in multiple high schools and districts and so on. In terms of skill sets and, curriculum and alignment. We have the skill sets, and this is an outgrowth of the National Career Cluster Movement in the different career areas. That is to say agricultural and natural resources, arts, information, communications, business, health, human resources, and industrial and engineering systems. So the career clusters on a national level looked at these frameworks and created the standards, and they were vetted through business and industry. And as this Oregon's way, we've organized it into our own, a little bit different, but nonetheless based on the national work, and vetted them with Oregon business and industry, which gives it, I think, a higher validity in the community. Also, if you have your advisory groups and folks participating in that. And so each program has an advisory committee in the community, and they participate, especially when a teacher is part of that community coming into the school district as a former business person, now becoming a teacher, which is a whole other piece to this as well. But the skill sets for the high school and the community colleges, the idea is that it's not duplicative. It's consistent, it's sequential, so a student who's taken these courses in the high school doesn't have to duplicate it in the community college, and it raises the level of curriculum across the board. The data we report to the federal government not only has to do with technical skill assessment, but it also is with how our students perform on English language arts in the state testing system and on mathematics. So, and we are required as part of these programs to integrate academics into the programs. And, you know, just on a basic level, not very many folks realize it, that the reading level for technical manuals that these students have to read is much higher than, you know, college literature. So the fact that we are working with teachers to look at how do you teach literacy within your programs has met with a little bit of resistance, but they too know that these are skills their students are going to need. And mathematics, I think it is easier for people to see that. The difficulty comes from business and industry and traditional mathematics use the same concepts, but they have a different vocabulary. How you design a home, for example, obviously uses geometry, but it doesn't translate that necessarily into the work in the classroom. And so part of the work we do now, as you could say, with linking learning, applied academics, and so on, is to bring the language of business and industry as well as the standards themselves into the everyday language with the students. And it has paid off. Let's see. Right now, like I said, we have about 600 programs of study, $15 million in federal funds support them. There are other career and technical education opportunities that are singletons opportunities out there that are not a part of a program of study. The Perkins supports those state-approved programs and teachers that meet the requirements for the CTE license, which I'd like to do a little bit of connection to your comment about teachers being prepared to teach the articulation. This is the biggest problem, I would say, is when you pull in, and it's happened more recently because we no longer offer the career and technical education at higher ed for teacher preparation. Ag has a great program still in place at Oregon State. Family and Consumer Sciences is hanging on by its fingernails. There is no more business program that gives the career and technical endorsement, and there is no more computer technology program. So the teachers that come out of the university are prepared to teach in these areas without the necessary work experience that really gives them that key understanding of career and technical ed, vocational, professional, technical, whatever you want to call it. So when it comes to articulating a course, and the minimum level of preparation for a CTE teacher is an AA degree, it makes it real difficult to be able to offer an articulated course when the minimum is a master's degree. So we've been working with our teacher corps as they're coming more and more out of business and industry to up that. Another piece of that is as they have to have and had in the past 15 credits of teacher preparation. We've upped that in the last iteration of CTE teacher licensure to be 18 credits, and it includes how to teach literacy and how to teach math in a particular subject area. The problem with teachers in the past has been how do I get into a teacher preparation program to get those courses? What we found is if you're not part of a cohort, it's next to impossible. And if you're teaching all day and being part of a teacher preparation cohort, it doesn't work. So we have, in order to keep that opportunity open for people from the business to come in, we have worked with Western Oregon University to offer an 18-credit online module so that they offer the teacher pedagogy through Western Oregon, and it is online, so it can be reached by the folks that come into the system in Eastern Oregon, Central Oregon, on the coast, wherever. And this is our first year, and it's, like I say, it's in development for all of it, but we are offering our first contingent of courses this year. And it's been well received, and simply because, of course, the cost is amenable and the accessibility is huge for that particular population. Nonetheless, the ability to get a master's degree from an AA degree is a challenge. So that's, if you want an articulation, and alignment and articulation is a core element of the program of study. So we have had to say, well, if you are aligned at a minimum, and your students can take those courses and show technical skill assessment and so on, but the goal would be to be able to offer the articulated credit, meshing the two systems even more. And I think that's all I have at the moment. So any questions on that before I go on to something else?
Any questions about the career technical piece of this? Mm-hmm. I do have one question, and that's, I hear that Perkins funding is in jeopardy at the national level. I guess that's perennial, but that's where we apparently are now. What will happen to these programs if Oregon loses its Perkins funding?
Coach Redembro, I'd hate to say, and I know that that's been, like you said, it's been a perennial issue. It came up when I was teaching and an administrator and so on. So how do you prepare yourself? I think it comes down to the school district and how they're prepared to offer, again, more options for students. Because in the end, we're changing all along things that were acceptable or reasonably accessible in the 1950s and 1970s, like auto shop or an auto program, whatever you want to call it, agricultural program. They're not the same. School districts are pooling their resources. They want to provide these opportunities for students. I don't know. I see people and school districts reinventing themselves and trying to meet the needs of these students. The shop areas are expensive to maintain. When I started teaching in Oregon in Lapine High School, it was a brand new school, small school, barely 300 students at the time. It came with full shops. They're all gone today. They're all gone. And it's disheartening in that regard, but I don't have an answer for you. I think they're going to have to reinvent themselves somehow. Yeah, sorry.
Mm-hmm. Rep. Johnson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. They chuckle, I guess, at your comments about reinventing it. We seem to talk about that a lot in Oregon. You know, just the other day we're talking about biomass stuff in our Ag and Natural Resources Committee, you know, allowing woody, Rep. Springer knows what I'm talking about, woody debris to be classified as a fuel for biomass. And in the old days, the mills used to do that, you know. But we've taken away that ability, but now suddenly it's a sexy thing again, and we want to bring it back in again. So, but in regards to, you know, home ec and you know, again, schools, especially in our district, we had all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But ODE and their wisdom, you know, focused us in a different direction, so those become less used facilities, they become other things, and now we're supposed to put them back again. So I guess I'm not directing this at you. I'm just saying that it's just, you know, we've been around this mountain before. But I guess my question to you would be, in regards to ODE, and maybe you know this, maybe you don't, but the number of credits required for graduation, you know, to get an Oregon diploma, I think, is 24. Is that correct? Okay. Districts can have more than that if they choose to. You'll hear from Principal Neitzel later, you know, we have 26 and a half in Hood River, but I'm wondering if has there been conversations at a state level about creating categories of diplomas. For instance, a basic level diploma, this gets you Oregon stamp of approval, but let's say at the 24 level. But if you want to spend additional time in your high school career, and we're going to make it available for you through dual enrollment, through expanded options and so forth, to get a higher ed ready diploma or a career technical ready diploma or something, and really working collaboratively with school districts to ensure that everybody's on the same page here across the state. And not, I mean, it's great to let districts have higher standards. That's great. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying from collaboration between ODE, the local districts, to where we, as a state, we're really focused on this next level and trying to give students every opportunity they can to be successful.
Co-Chair Johnson, Dembro, I think there are several aspects to that. One is that the department is certain requirements to implement the federal legislation, as at least in my department, such as No Child Left Behind mm-hmm. and Perkins legislation. And as those are the things that we are focused on, and many other pieces fall away because of funding and so on, mm-hmm. because of that issue of supplanting and supporting. If we're getting funds, federal funds, to do a specific thing, then if I were to do something else with that money, it would be supplanting federal funds. And so our focus then, because those funds are what pay us pretty much, it narrows the focus. So for example, the Perkins and the programs of study, because the funding stream has these requirements with it, that's where we focus. Mm. I would say that in looking at the locally developed options, that's where you're seeing some of that work happening. And then I'll back up for a second because I'm going to go down that path in a minute. But I remember when the state board was wrestling with the diploma requirements for 24. The statute talks about that Oregon diploma, that's really the minimum. And it doesn't preclude other districts from creating additional opportunities.
Sometimes
dependent on their schedule they offer. Block schedules, trimesters, and so they take it and they run with it, and they come up with great opportunities for kids. The state board at that time wrestled with, what about accelerated diplomas and so on? But there was the sense that this is Oregon, it's local control, they have developed these accelerated diplomas, advanced diplomas, whatever you want to call it, based on local need. And this is, you know, from my opinion as an ODE person who's gone out and had to tell folks what to do, what's expected with the rule, you know, there's a certain amount of resistance to the people listening to you and saying, or the ODE has said you must do this, and taken away a locally developed option. So that was pretty much off the table. There is wide range opportunity for folks to create their own. And as a matter of fact, in locally developed options, I know that the most widely known one at this point is the PACE program out of SIO. And when Gary Temple decided, he looked at his data and said, my students are successful in high school, but when they get to the community college or the college, they're not. What's wrong with this picture, and how to develop that? And at the time, I was working with SIO on their pilot for credit for proficiency and their research and design site, and we've always asked districts to look at their data and make decisions based on their data. So, I mean, Gary had done his homework, and he worked with the department to help develop an option and that expanded diploma or his accelerated diploma in this particular program. It's created some tension in the system because it overlaps with students taking off in a fifth year through SIO and attending community colleges. But without people going there and pushing that envelope, we don't have any state programs, and we don't have a pathway, because the state funding is this way for high schools, it's this way for community colleges and university and so on. So creating that seamless system, not just in curriculum and so on, but creating it in terms of dollars, that's
That's a bigger discussion.
That's the wide and deep.
But that's one that's going on in the building right,
right.
now, also,
and
as you well
I,
know.
And I think it's an important one to have, but I couldn't begin to answer.
Sure. Well, it's good just to see the need for system-wide collaboration, and I think that's what we all can see coming out of this discussion. We can't just focus on one little entity because it's influenced by what comes in and what goes out.
Yeah. We actually had a task force that met over the last biennium, and Larry, I think you came and spoke to us. Laura Roach was in the back from ODE, was part of it, looking specifically at enhanced collaborations between school districts and community colleges, business and industry, and potentially partnerships between districts in an attempt to find a viable path to restoring CTE into the schools. And actually, we're going to be hearing a bill, not in this committee, but in the Education Committee, that everyone will have a chance to vote on. Thank you.
Okay. I'd talk a little bit about locally developed, other locally developed programs.
Yes.
And the data we collect from the expanded options tells us if school districts have other options and if they do a credit and so on. And they, if they have other, we ask them to tell what it is. So some of the pieces, such as PACE, we have a lot of school districts doing some things with similar names. They do distance learning through out-of-state entities. They also connect with out-of-state community colleges and universities, because on the eastern end of the state, they're closer, actually. You know, the community college of Walla Walla and University and Boise State, they're closer geographically, and it's easier for them to connect. So they have those programs going, and they have other regional technical education opportunities, such as PACE. There are hybrids on that, where students, by the time they graduate, perhaps with that fifth year towards an advanced diploma, they can have an AA degree and a high school diploma at the same time. And you know, and that brings up a real interesting scenario as the person who answers the phone a lot when I get those questions. And there is a certain amount of angst in the system for different school districts who try to do it differently, because they say they're taking the state school fund and so on. Whenever I have gotten a phone call to say, well, can they actually do this, it is the answer that I've given you. The state diploma is the minimum. If the student has not gotten a diploma, and the district sees by other statute that student needs additional education, they can do that. I don't want to pass the judgment to say right, wrong, or indifferent, but it is within the law. And I believe when Gary developed his program, he was very careful to make sure he was in the law. I can't testify to anyone else's, but there are those other hybrid options happening, and there's the push out there to try and connect the system more so people don't feel disenfranchised from that. So that's what I have on those pieces. The last segment that I have, and this is a little bit on advanced placement and international baccalaureate, and those two are obviously similar because they're national and international standards and curriculum. But the key piece to those is also that the credit is not given from the course. The credit is given by result of an exam. And then the student has to take that exam and perhaps market it where they want to go. Now, in the state, there is a certain amount of agreement on what is a 3 worth and a 4 worth and so on, and that's wonderful. I mean, when my two children went through school, that was not the case. And although my son went outside, his 3 on AP went with him to Arizona State. He was also an international baccalaureate, and there are levels of exams for international baccalaureate. If you have a full-blown program, and when I was in Hillsborough and they were developing their program, they started out at that lower level, and they had exams for that. And even though my son had taken those courses, he chose not to take the test because that credit would not transfer wherever he went. It wouldn't be accepted. So it's a great opportunity. It's great preparation. Good experience. It connects the high school and the university, but it is not a given credit. And so that's a key piece for those. I think You know, having taught advanced placement 30 years ago, I can tell you it was a great opportunity for my children that and students in the classroom. I wouldn't have traded that experience for them, especially in Lapine. It was a wonderful opportunity for them. And international baccalaureate, they also offer a diploma, but not all students are required to get that diploma. They can take courses, they get their exams, and they take that with them. We also have, of course, the Oregon Test Fee Program, which if you've looked at the news from Senator Wyden's office, we also have been approved this year. Last year, we had 4,804 exams for income-qualified students. And that the main income qualifier is the free and reduced lunch, but there are other contributing factors for students. And you know, in high school, a lot of students don't want to admit that they are in an economic situation. They don't apply often for free and reduced lunch programs. They don't want the stigma. So there are other opportunities to support them in that. And we anticipate in 2011 having over 6,000 exams. So it's a thriving program, and it's a great opportunity for students.
Great. Suzanne, could you say something about how the Oregon University system is implementing the international baccalaureate results or the advanced placement?
Coach Denbro, I really don't know.
Okay, Larry.
Chair Denbro, actually, just today I prepared a message to go out to the chief academic officers and registrars with the newly adopted alignment for course credits for both advanced placement and international baccalaureate. Those were reviewed and then approved by Unified Education Enterprise a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, it's a great step. Mm-hmm. And they'll apply both to OUS schools and community colleges?
Absolutely. Yep.
Great. Other questions for the panelists? No. I would like to go back to the question about the funding for the different programs, and thinking particularly about the dual credit ones. It's always kind of perplexed me a little bit that the why the community colleges get full reimbursement for their dual credit participation, since it's so, you know, relatively speaking, so minor compared to the investment that the school districts do. I mean, they're paying, you know, that it's their space, it's their teachers, you know, et cetera. The community colleges certainly are involved in the partnership and the, you know, the alignment and the paperwork to some extent. But I wonder if you could explain that, and I guess Larry,
sure.
Since you're the CCWD person.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Chair Denbro, you know, we haven't, and I used to be a dual credit coordinator at Chemeketa Community College, and even when I was at Chemeketa, we didn't do a breakdown of exactly how much a course or a, you know, the FTE funding formula is not a one-to-one match. It's fairly complicated, and you know, it's reliant on how many hours of total instruction, and then it's based on average and so forth. But we did look at costs to not only the transcripting fee, but some of the other associated, you know, paperwork that you mentioned, and also the cost of releasing faculty to be able to do the type of professional development and collegial interaction that's required. And the standards are pretty specific around what is required of a program. I mean, at Chemeketa at the time, there were three meetings or three professional development opportunities per year that were required of faculty to be involved in with high school faculty. So, you know, where does the funding then come from for the community college in that whole setup? Not from any charges, usually. Most of Oregon's community colleges charge nothing for the credit for a student. I think the highest rate is about $32 or so per course, which in light of what tuition is, that's still quite a bargain, and it probably covers, you know, basically a transcripting fee. So, that said, we've not really looked at how that breaks out, but there are some costs associated with the community college part of it that I think probably do, you know, add up over time.
I'm not saying that we're double paying, but yeah. I think we perhaps are paying more than we absolutely need to is just a concern that I have.
You know, and Chair Denbrough, I think that's a concern that when the Unified Education Enterprise explored the need for program standards, and at that point they had a dual credit task force, which was made up of university system, K-12, you know, all of the partners. That was a question that came up during that time, and really it had to do with providing professional development for instructors. How would that be funded? Well, that task force at the time said, take a look at what revenue is coming into these programs and how you would use it. And I think that's what a lot of the colleges have done.
And actually, just to step back and answer my own, argue against myself, of course, just to remind us that we're not in a situation where we're fully funding community colleges. So the extra credit, the extra FTE is not necessarily bringing in extra dollars, since we have, you know, a fixed pot of money that's just getting divided up smaller and smaller. But I do think it's something to look at for the future. Other questions or
good reports?
Okay, thank you both of you for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll call up Karen Neitzel, please. Okay, Karen, welcome. If you could introduce yourself, and before you do so, I just want to say I've heard great things about your school district from my co-chair here.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I might just add that Ms. Neitzel is well appreciated in our district. I really think she's one of the probably the best and the brightest of the building administrators in Oregon. We're excited to have her in Hood River and being the principal of Hood River Valley High School. We're proud of our school, and I'm sure Karen will represent the district well today. So thanks for being here.
No pressure, right?
Other than that, have fun.
So Chair Denbrough and the committee, I'm excited to be here. I'm happy to have this opportunity. You saw a huge stack of paper that I put through, and one of the things you asked for from Suzanne, I actually have a copy of, so it's in there, the expanded options report.
Great, thank you.
And so as Mark said, my name's Karen Neitzel. I'm principal at Hood River Valley High School in Hood River. And some of the things I prepared, Suzanne and Larry covered, so I'm going to brief by them. So just to give you kind of a picture, we're considered a rural high school, and what that really means is that 51% of our students are reported to be free and reduced lunch, and that means we have a larger number of students that actually aren't, because, again, they don't like the stigma of reporting themselves, which is unfortunate because there's a lot of advantages to them. On those testing fees, anything to do with AP testing, which I'll bring up later, they don't actually have to pay to take the test. So it's unfortunate. You can see our demographics, 43% Hispanic, very small percentages of other ethnic background students, and 8.6% of our students are migrant. And that number has gone down significantly in the past few years. 85% of our students plan some sort of post-secondary experience, whether that's military, college, technical college. So really, we're really proud of those numbers. And our dropout rate is consistently low compared to the state dropout rate. We've also had a number of awards given their school, particularly for our ag program. And, you know, they're mentioning the demise of shops in high schools in Oregon. And we're trying to keep ours alive, especially in a farming community. It's really important. And if you have questions as I go, please ask. They address college now, dual credit. And one of the things I think for our students, not just the credit piece, but for our students, it's a key preparation for them for college to be successful. They get a sense of what a college course requires And that's really important for the colleges to get our students who have had that experience in high school. A little safer atmosphere for them to experience that. Some of the limitations for us, as was mentioned earlier, if our teachers don't have the right certification as required by the community colleges, we can't offer courses in those areas. And so that is a limit. As far as cost savings for students, huge. And one of the pieces I handed out is this double-sided, stapled together, and it actually shows you what the tuition cost for the students are for any College Now classes, which I thought would be really interesting. It's interesting for me to look at Hood River with Columbia Gorge Community College. And the limitation we have as a rural school is that we have one community college that's readily accessible to our kids, and it's a newer college. So they don't have some of the developed programs that Lane or PCC would have. And so our kids do have limited access for those reasons.
Karen, can I ask you a question?
Sure.
I noticed the textbooks, mm-hmm. used college-approved textbooks. We actually had a hearing last week on textbook affordability at the college level, and I assume that's a challenge for you, I mean, the cost of your textbooks in general. But these are provided free of charge to the students, but mm-hmm. the district pays for those, right?
No.
They have to purchase their textbooks.
Yeah, so... For Writing 121, which everyone seems to know what that is, students do pay for their book. If we have students who we think can't afford a book, then we have special funds that have been given to us by donors that we pay for their books for them. But we found it also gives them a more realistic picture of a college process. You have your book. You're responsible for your book. If you lose your book, you don't have any more. You can write in it. So there's just all the things with college that we're preparing our high school kids for. And you talked about online courses. So we offer a hybrid 121. So it's partially online, partially in the classroom. And what the teacher we have does is actually have the online days. You can be in the classroom with her, and she'll walk you through the lessons so that you have that experience and preparation. Or you can do it from home.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have the same expectations any online college course would have. And then we have another teacher who's in English, who's qualified to teach 115, 121, and she's working with a high school in Eastern Oregon to do a hybrid option. She's going to go visit to their school 3 days during the school year to provide that to the kids, and the rest of it's going to be online.
Mm-hmm. So your online, say, 121 is coming out of one of the colleges?
Yes, and then CGCC.
Okay, mm-hmm. And then you have a local district teacher who's doing the face-to-face component.
She actually developed the class and is doing both.
Okay.
But we have another teacher who's had the request of a high school in Eastern Oregon to actually come face-to-face and do the rest of it online to give them access, because they don't have access right now.
I think that's a great model.
Yeah, okay. We're excited to be part of that.
Great.
And this is just shows you kind of the different College Now classes we have at the high school. We have over 500 students currently enrolled in classes where they could get credits. We have 1,200 students total. So not quite half, but it's a big number. And a variety of classes, animal science. We have a really great ag department, as I mentioned before, and so we're fortunate to have students get those experiences. And then Spanish and theater and the writing classes. And then Suzanne explained all of expanded options. So I put this slide together not knowing what kind of background you'd have, so I'll just skip right by. But specifically for us and just the implementation of expanded options, some of the things, and again, this is preparing students for college, is they get an expanded options course, which the district's paying for, and then they fail that course. So what do you put in place? Because it doesn't obviously go on our transcript. They're going to get a college transcript. We explain you're going to have a failing course listed on your college transcript. You understand you might not be eligible for athletics because you're taking that under the school district. It affects your OSAA eligibility. And then we don't allow you to take any other courses through expanded options if you fail the course. And those are just things we put in place through experience with kids.
So can I ask, so the kids who are taking expanded options courses, are they going to the Columbia Gorge campus for those courses?
In most cases, some have taken online courses mm-hmm. through other OUS schools, but in most cases they go to Columbia Gorge.
Mm-hmm. And generally for just one or two classes, or are they going full time there? How are they tending to do it?
It varies widely. One student who graduated last year who took 42 credits through expanded options, she did all of her pre-nursing. She was super motivated. It was a great experience for her, great experience for us, because we had a motivated student who was focused, and she got the benefit of the district funding for that. So it ranges from one class to once students get into it, they're usually taking two classes a semester.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, if a student was interested in accelerated learning, they would go to a counselor and talk about their options, presumably, mm-hmm. right? And is there a tendency to steer them towards dual credit courses, the College Now courses, or to the expanded options? Is there a plus or a minus to either of those?
We consider the College Now classes as just part of what we offer at the high school. And so we tell them about the dual credit piece, but if they're looking for something outside of what we offer at the high school, we talk about expanded options. And that's where it's a real benefit to us. As you know, as a school of 1,200, we feel big, but we're not a school of 3,000. And you can offer different things at different levels when you have a smaller group of kids. So I think it's a great opportunity for kids for classes we don't offer.
Great, thanks. Representative Springer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I'm moving ahead too quickly, forgive me. I thought I saw the word aspire somewhere, so I'm wondering if you're going to get
here.
There. The question is always not so much those kids that are going to do great things either with our help or in spite of us, and mm-hmm. we all know those kids in our school. They're doing amazing things. What about those kids that maybe don't have all that support and that push from home? What are some of the things that you're doing to bring those students on board, saying this is a very real option, and it's a very real option just for you, too?
Yeah, so I do have a couple of slides on Aspire, and I have brought this, and I know this is
okay.
A lot of paper.
Okay, I won't make you bump ahead now.
I'm fine.
Okay.
So this packet, and I brought it because we're really proud of this, we have meetings with our junior parents and to get them ready for the college experience of their senior students, and we have a number of... Okay, Mark's on his last one.
I missed
one.
That meeting. Go ahead.
I think Melody was there.
Yeah.
And really trying to give parents a heads up who've never been through the process, because once you've been through it, you never forget it. But
exactly.
If you haven't been through it, you really need to get some background. And so we have informational meetings for our parents and students, and give out this packet. We're working on getting it translated into Spanish, but when we do the presentations, we have presentations in English and in Spanish both. And we're going to expand that to our sophomore parents, because we had a number of sophomore parents show up this year who were really interested in making sure they knew everything they needed to know, which is great, and so we're just going to expand it to two nights next year. But we give all this information out because we want to make sure that everyone has access to post-secondary options, whether it's a four-year college, two-year, or career technical. It also gives a lot of information about requirements at University of Washington, Oregon State schools, California schools, so some of the schools that our kids are usually going to. So this I had to share, just as a bragging
great.
Piece. And one of the things, just to finish up expanded options, is the district budgeted $40,000, and so whatever isn't used rolls over to the next year. It becomes part of our ending fund balance. So it's not wasted, because we get to use it in some other way. And you can see the first year we were in, we had two high schools, Cascade Locks High School and Hood River Valley High School, and about half of those dollars all the way through to 9-10 were from Cascade Locks High School, because they had a much smaller school, much more limited offerings, and they took a lot of classes through Mount Hood Community College. And so that's why our numbers are so different. And again, there's our student who paid nothing for 42 credits, saving her and her family $2,700. So, great experience. AP, Suzanne talked about AP classes. Again, You don't earn credit unless you take the exam and get a certain score, and that varies by universities. We're really fortunate to have state and federal assistance for the students who qualify. So they can't afford the exam fee. We do a waiver. I actually talked to Suzanne, and she helps cover the students. The part that the federal government doesn't cover, the state covers another portion of that. So it's a great opportunity. 300 students annually at our high school take the test, and over 60% get a 3 or better. So 60% are getting an opportunity to earn college credit while they're in high school. So it's another great option. Again, it's a college-level course preparing them for the rigors of college and what the expectations are. So it's also good in that way. And over half of our seniors took 2 or more AP classes, which is also pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. And those are the offerings we have. Out of 30 possible AP courses you could have, we have 12. Mm-hmm. And then Aspire. So Aspire is an incredible program for us, and we're really fortunate that the OSAC, Oregon Student Assistance Commission, has established that for our kids. And essentially, it trains mentors to work in our schools with students, all students, and to make sure that they know all their options after high school. And they work with students one-on-one in our Summit Center at the high school, and they do phenomenal work with our kids. We currently have 25 volunteers who are there every week, and they're working with approximately 300 students overall. So between the staff we have in Summit, we have FAFSA nights, so when you're working on your federal application for free student aid, we have nights for those. So every year we're serving about 300 students, and that includes a lot of our juniors. Primary focus is on our seniors, making sure they're getting through. And the volunteers do a great job of, tracking their applications, scholarships, essays. And so there's a lot of effort by the community to support our kids to be successful and whatever their next step is.
And, Karen, how long have you been part of Aspire or using Aspire?
I want to say it's been there about 10 years.
Okay. And have you seen an increase in the number of students going on to post-secondary education?
Yes, definitely. We have a number of about 50 students of a graduating class of 300 every year, the first in their family ever graduate from high school. And then a large number of those students go on to college. And so we definitely have 85% of our students are looking at something post-secondary. So I think that's kind of proof that Aspire is really working with our kids. And then they just, 25% of our students, because you're talking about the OUS system, attend OUS schools. And our persistence rates are 10 to 30% higher than other high schools in Oregon. And I think that's because of this pink packet, making sure we have a saying, college is a match to be made, not a prize to be won. I brought that with me from California when I worked at a private school. So really, it's about making sure kids are finding the right fit, and that really helps with persistence. If it's a place they feel comfortable and they feel prepared academically by taking those pre-college classes, dual credit, AP, expanded options, whatever those are, they're more prepared. And this, I don't know if this is going to work or not.
Those are very impressive statistics.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Doing this presentation was great because I got to look at information I don't always look at, and so mm-hmm. it was definitely a feel-good opportunity. So. Mm-hmm. Works. This is okay. I don't think the wireless is up. This link actually shows you, it's a really cool graphic of the state of Oregon with all the counties. And as you mouse over a county, it'll show you which options that county has, whether they have expanded options, AP, IB,
cool.
College Now. So it's a really neat graphic where you can see what everyone's offering. I thought it'd be useful for you since you're representing different areas of the state. So that's it, unless you have questions.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. What about, Karen, if you could talk a bit about teacher certification for expanded options, and are there teachers within HRV who would be interested but for whatever reason just haven't been able to obtain the training or certification that they would need to have to be qualified as instructors?
Yes, there are. So in math, we did have a teacher who had a master's. You need to have a master's degree in math to be certified by the community college to teach a high school course that would give you dual credit. And not many teachers in schools have master's degrees in math. They're in engineering or the business world. And so we have a number of teachers who I think would be very capable, but they don't have those degrees. And so in math and science in particular, I think there could be another number of opportunities that teachers would be interested in pursuing if the standards were a little bit different.
So it's the time to pursue the degree, but also likely the cost entailed as well, I'm sure.
Right, or if there's other options, perhaps, if you know, they look at your transcript and decide,
right,
have you had enough higher level in math or science, and so making sure they could take those extra few classes, and it just gives our kids a lot of opportunities that they don't have right now.
Mm-hmm. And committee, just to remind you, our very first day as a committee when we were meeting jointly with the Senate, we heard about Senate bill, whatever it is, what is it, the dual credit bill,
mm-hmm,
I don't know, some bill, that came out of the higher ed work group, that task force that met over the summer, and it, in addition to encouraging districts, or actually ordering districts to have some kind of accelerated learning option, creates a fund that would be partly funded by the state, partly by the school district, I think, and then there'd be an expectation of an individual contribution by the teacher in order to help pay for them to go back to school and get those get the content-based masters. That
mm-hmm
did pass out of the Senate Education Committee, and it's sitting in the Ways and Means Committee because it has obviously a price tag attached to it, and I think we'll probably be hearing it whenever we start hearing policy bills.
Okay. Another follow-up.
Yeah.
In regards to the courses that we currently offer, HRV offers for dual and credit and so forth, and 121 was there obviously, but I didn't see anything really in the sciences or in the technical career ed type thing. And I wondered if you've had conversations with, for instance, Dr. Toad at Columbia Gorge about their, you know, their high tech, high energy services type stuff that they're doing, and again, the way that we could provide a segue into their program with some more expanded options. And I guess what I'm asking is it just the fact that we don't have someone that has the qualifications or certified to teach in that content area, or have you pursued those kind of discussions or had those kind of communication with the community college?
So the person I normally connect with at the community college is Susan Wolf, not Toda.
Sure.
And they have a lot of other things going on as a newer school that's not yet accredited, that I think trying to pursue other opportunities with them right now, it's not a good time.
Okay.
For them. We certainly have enough teachers who would be willing to pursue things. I mean, Jeff Blackman,
right,
is a
that's what
prime
I'm thinking.
Example
perfect.
Of an engineering genius who
we just won. You can brag if you
yeah
want.
Yeah, so we were in the Oregonian on Saturday, if you didn't notice, for our robotics team.
Oh, yeah.
And it's mostly girls, and they're just really bright, quirky, amazing girls, and they're being honored on Sunday by the WCIT, and I don't remember what that stands for, so please forgive me. And they nominated their teacher as an inspirational person, and these 15-year-old girls who are sophomores are now going to pursue engineering thanks to this experience they've had with robotics. And so yeah, we have a number of teachers like that, really talented, who could support kids to get on a track and get them college credit at the same time, which would be great.
Thank you. Rep. Lindsay?
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chair. This is a little bit outside the scope of the conversation, but you mentioned that I believe it was over 51%. I'm just going to take advantage of this opportunity to have you to ask this question. Over 51% are on free or reduced lunch. I know that in my school district, in my house district, the numbers are quite high as well. Can you just educate me quickly on what the requirements are, what the qualifications are for free and reduced lunch? That would be the first question. And mm-hmm. then the second question would be, maybe you can provide some insight on why those numbers are that high, or what's being done to control those numbers.
So it's actually a federal number that's put out, and so I don't know the exact qualifier, but it's poverty level of a family, and so families have to apply. And it's a pretty extensive application process to decide whether or not you qualify for free lunch or reduced lunch. But again, that number, it's a family that's under poverty level, but I don't know the exact salary, what that is for household. And then on the second piece, Horace, can you repeat that question, the second part?
That's all right. You don't have to answer that. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Anybody in the back know the answer to that question? What it takes to be eligible for free or reduced lunch?
Per capita income.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It is.
We don't have the exact numbers here with us right now, but I'd be happy to send those up to the committee.
Thank you.
I'm glad I'm not the only one who doesn't know.
Okay. Any other questions?
No, not now.
Okay. Thank you very much, Karen, for coming down. Rev. Johnson. Any final?
No, just thanks. We're proud to talk about our school district and our school, and Karen's doing a great job. But just to piggyback on Rep. Springer's question about Aspire, that program works because of the community. Mm-hmm. The volunteer hours that go into that are amazing. And but again, we're in a niche. We're a school district that's large enough to have some cool stuff, but not so large that people become disconnected and lack involvement. So mm-hmm. we're kind of that perfect size, I think, in a lot of areas.
Mm-hmm.
But the involvement, it really is what makes it happen, the volunteer hours and so forth. So
it's terrific.
Okay, thank you, Karen.
Thank you very much.
Great. So I'm going to bring this information session to an end. And we're going to get out early today. I hope there are no complaints about that. A warning that won't be the case on Thursday.
Thursday we might go long.
We have a very packed agenda.
We'll just carry it over.
We're going to be doing work sessions on a couple of bills we've heard before, and we have a whole series of bills related to career colleges and measures related to them. So,
if anybody wants to go finish the end of the U of O proposal in front of the Senate Ed Committee, they're in session right now.
Okay, great. Okay, all our guests, thank you for coming. And with that, I will end this March 1st hearing of the Subcommittee on Higher Education.